Hello and welcome back to the Faber Poetry Podcast. I'm Rachel Allen.
And I'm Jack Underwood.
On this week's episode, we have an interview with Fiona Benson and Julia Copus, and audio postcards from Morgan Parker, Wendy Cope and Bobby Parker.
Lilac Wine by Eartha Kitt versus Lilac Wine by Jeff Buckley. How many men before I understand? I don't want to, but I do. Invade, try to breathe from their mouths. The master's tools, I have them. The house is getting too big. My people, their style, there's misery. The finest imports, tender, bittersweet. I want to build a reef for us, fill it with arrows.
That was Morgan Parker kicking off the show this week with a poem from her new book, Magical Negro. I'm really excited because Morgan's coming over this summer. She's got a London reading. I'm running a residency with her.
Oh, that'd be so
in
exciting.
Devon. I can't wait.
Yeah.
And her book is published by Tin House in the US.
Rachel, who do we have in the studio today?
Fiona Benson's pamphlet was Faber New Poets 1 in the Faber New Poets series, and her first full-length collection, Bright Travellers, published with Cape in 2014, received the Seamus Heaney Prize for Best First Collection and the Jeffrey Faber Memorial Prize. Her extraordinary second book, Vertigo and Ghost, is also published by Cape and was out in January this year. Fiona, what would you like to read for us today?
I thought I might read Meningitis, if that's all right.
Of course, yeah.
Meningitis. My grandmother, diminished in her bones, loyal to her large print mills and Boone and her soaps, bent perpendicular over her Zimmer, weeping, still weeping for her daughter June, who was sweet, so sweet, the child of her heart, soft blonde curls and forget-me-not eyes, gentle and kind. How June took care of the evacuees, holding out their towels as they stepped from the disinfectant bath to be deloused. How, after all that, the world's war and its shell-shocked peace, the Mickey Mouse gas mask packed away at last, June went to bed with half a soluble aspirin for a headache, and by the morning was gone. The way my grandmother tells it, she didn't know there was anything out of the ordinary wrong. And June died in the night, in wet sheets, alone, as the terrible roses bloomed beneath her skin. My grandmother out of her mind with pain, writhing and kicking on the kitchen linoleum, while my uncle as a boy watched on. Which is why my father came to be born, to bring her back to the living, a baby to hold. And this is my inheritance, this heirloom of grief, the way my daughter's fevers crush me, how I check their skin obsessively for telltale burns, how I scoop them out of the flames where the devil eats them. Daughter, like a hot poultice, I hold against my frightened heart the marks I make above my door that the angel of the plague might pass. Where my grandmother waits, standing on the threshold in her red velour slippers, unable to step over, peering fearfully into the dark.
Julia Kobus is the author of four poetry collections, The Shuttered Eye, In Defence of Adultery, and The World's Two Smallest Humans, which was shortlisted for both the T.S. Eliot and Costa Poetry Award. She won first prize in the National Poetry Competition and the Forward Prize for Best Single Poem. I've checked and it was two different poems on two different occasions. And her most recent collection, Girlhood, is published by Faber and Faber this year. Julia, what have you chosen to read for us today?
So I thought I would read a poem that's maybe not typical of mine, called Sunday Morning at Oscars. Sunday Morning at Oscars. I'd left the village to its farrago of dog walkers, devil dodgers, and kids hurling their cries and compact bodies skywards on the Vanderplank's endlessly lissom trampoline and made for town. My catabolic nerves had run me ragged, which is how I found myself, goosed and fretful, pootling among the mirrored pillars and caramel-coloured wood panelling of Oscars. Once again, it amazes me how easily I may be soothed by orderly rows of hosiery. The trick is to give yourself up to the calm of it, the white and the black packets, each one forward-facing, ranged as in a child's bookcase. Oh, Mr. Wordsworth, I say aloud, the world is not enough with us, and am drawn immediately to the silken samples that hang on the wall, head-height, like trophy tails, and soon I'm stretching one over my hand, and then another, trying them for colour, nearly nude, powder, noisette, illusion. I go on, up the steps to cosmetics, and am happy there for a good 5 minutes, painting earnest stripes on the back of my left hand in shades of coral and pink. Lately I'm enthralled to my ersatz sense of otherness. Praise be for the narcissism of small differences. The silver lipstick boxes ranked like terracotta soldiers lightly joggle, lightly right themselves again, as I open the commodious drawer, lift out a luminous rose boudoir, and seeing the tills deserted, drop the packet into my Macintosh pocket. Then how quickly it begins to feel at home there, nested like an egg. Two naked alabaster mannequins recede behind me as I trace my steps back over the blonde carpet. Near the exit, three shoulder bags, the size of small dogs, crouch straight out of one of my pellucid dreams on a low wood table. And I'm back in the street with the pram faces, the kooks and mavericks, lank, slope-shouldered desperados, some of them turning with me now into the passage of Magdalen Walk, where above us the vast closed-petaled winds of late mid-morning cluster, and I push my feet one after the other, on, then on a little quicker than usual, because it looks like rain.
Thank you. And as is tradition on our podcast, we ask our guests to bring in something that sort of represents their writing practice or their poems or basically anything they want to bring in to share with us. What do you have to share with us, Julia?
Well, I struggled slightly with this because I've been asked to do it once before.
Oh,
so I wanted to find...
It's not our idea.
I wanted to find something different from that. And the night before I came up here, I remembered that I'd written this little poem when I was either 4 or 5 years old in my infant school. And I've got that with me. I don't know if you want to have a look. It's got pictures and everything.
Wow.
It's lovely.
And shall I read the poem out?
Yes, please.
It's barely legible, but it says... If I were to be in a cold and rolled sort of day with booms and brooms and crashes on their way, I would shiver and liver. If I were to be in a sunny and runny day, I don't quite know what I would say. I would feel sticky.
And that's sticky four person or five.
Yeah.
And that, but there's an interesting story. Yeah, there's a drawing, as Fee says,
of a sticky person.
Yeah. A sticky person looking happy.
And your sad person, your cold person under a fountain of purple hair. Yeah. Mm. And two smiling clouds.
Yeah.
I think that's really nice that the clouds are having a whale of a time. That, you know,
even
the
evil clouds. Yeah. Somebody's happy.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a good lesson to have latched onto early on.
But if you, I don't know if you can see, after the word liver.
Yeah.
When I showed this to the teacher, she said, you can't say I liver, I would liver. It's not a verb, or it's not a doing word. And so she made me write in, I would eat. So it says, I would shiver and liver, I would eat. But when she put it up on the wall, I was so upset, I rubbed out, I would eat.
Good for you.
The verb to liver, I liver. Yeah. He livers,
yeah,
she livers.
They can be absolutely so damaging from such an early age, can't they? Some things they say.
Yeah.
They.
Yeah. Just
who we're talking about here, Rachel.
Lovely teachers.
Yeah.
Of which my sister is one. But sometimes when a teacher says something like that, it can really stick in your mind.
I just noticed that the word evil appears backwards in the word liver. And I think it's a clue she was an evil teacher.
Oh, wow.
No, I think she was trying to do the right thing. Yeah. And teach me what a verb was, but I think that's one of the things that young children can do naturally, and that is so amazing. They've got a sort of natural bent for poetry and the feel of words.
Yeah, before ideology constrains them and forces them to. Yeah, to
I think if you'd had Rose and Isla's teacher, he'd have loved it. He'd have put it on the Star Wall.
Some teachers really can expand on that child, that way of thinking that's like naive but super creative.
Yeah.
And I feel like some teachers, they really want to enforce the rules.
Try and squash it a bit. Yeah.
Well, like it's a bit of ingenuity, isn't it, to verb a noun? That's like classic move.
Yeah, but it's interesting to do that naturally. When I mean, I'm quite certain that I'm not alone in doing that, that the young kids might do that. Naturally, and then it's something we suddenly rediscover as we get older and think is terribly exciting.
So interesting you retained that resistance, as well. You're still a poet, you're still shaping language in strange ways, right, and mysterious ways. You've held on to that childishness.
Excitement as well about it.
There's a good Mark Waldron essay about, in which he mentions a guy who was in his workshop who I think was French, maybe. So he was writing in his second language. And there was a period where his poems were kind of like struggling with that. And then gradually, after a couple of weeks or a few weeks, he'd got a lot better. But his language was still weird, like the constructions, the syntax, the words he would choose, the equivalents were sort of like quite unexpected. And the poems were brilliant. And then suddenly, a few weeks later, of course,
that disappeared
when they became quite boring and ordinary again, when he was getting, you know, the right word, when he was eating liver rather than just
feeling it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think that's it. I've judged a few sort of school poetry competitions as well, and I often find the younger years amazing. I'm really impressed. And then there's a certain stage at which they become self-conscious and feel the need to be clever or to be right, to use your word, Jack. And that's when it starts sort of going out the window a little bit poetically.
And a lot of the teaching that has to be done, I think, after like perhaps secondary or even A-level education in terms of writing, is that you basically get pats on the back for complicating a noun with many adjectives. You know, so it's like a sad, grey, shaggy, I don't know, misty dog or something.
Yeah.
Rather than, and then you have to just choose one, you know, you have to sort of basically say, no, choose one. Because if every noun is qualified five times, it's just sort of noisy.
Fee, would you like to talk about your talisman or lack of talisman?
Well, I haven't brought one. Firstly, because I forgot. And secondly, everything I love is very ephemeral, I suppose. I do collect stuff off the beach all the time, and so do the girls. So our house is basically full of beach crap, including like a crab claw, and I've got a little fish skeleton in a matchbox from Mozambique.
Do you have to clean them up?
Well, they get dusty. I did some of them. I disinfected, but the rest of them I haven't bothered, so they're probably just festering,
drying out
in the sun. That's always advised with fish things, isn't it? Because it sort of purifies or something.
You don't want to have them drying in the house, do you? Really?
No, it would be a bit stinky, wouldn't it?
We grew up with a mummified frog in our house as one of our curios, that I guess Dad had found on the... Well, it was preserved. It was dried out. No one had, taken its organ out. And put it in four separate jars.
Where is it now?
Goodness knows. It's probably still around somewhere, but it was a thing that it had its tongue had sort of withered very thin.
Sounds like a witch's curse.
Well, we used to lick the frog. It was like a dare, would you lick the frog?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe that's...
maybe lick the crab claw.
Have you tried anything like that out more?
You say that without any kind of realisation of the fact that it's very strange to lick a frog.
I don't know.
There's all sorts of kissing of frogs that goes on, isn't there?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think could be some residual hallucinogens or something interesting on the back of a frog.
On the skin of the frog.
Yeah, don't they do that?
Well, tree frogs are really poisonous, aren't they?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
So definitely wasn't those, because it would have killed you with a lick.
Definitely, and we should actually say to any listeners of the podcast...
Don't lick dead frogs.
Exactly, and do check at least what kind of frog it is before.
I think just don't.
That's probably safer. But tell me more about this sea ocean crap.
Well, there is a lot, and my daughter's tastes don't necessarily match my own, so they just like any old rock, basically, any rock, which can be tricky.
Yeah. What would you go for?
Well, I like little things. I've got some little, fossils and things. And I like crabs as well. I do like crab shells.
I used to be obsessed with finding dead crabs on the beach. I wonder if it's a childish thing. I'd get so excited when I'd see them, belly up and rotting. I'd be like, hey, I want to take this home.
Yeah,
and my mum would be like, no.
Don't touch that.
None of that. Nasty.
I'm really interested that you say you like really small things.
Yeah.
Because I do too, and I'm wondering if it's a poet thing to miniature. Do you think?
I don't know.
Items that you'd attach, small things, like ornaments in the house that you'd maybe attach some kind of meaning to or sentimental value.
Yeah, and just miniaturised things as well.
I think there's a sort of rule of cuteness that if something's smaller than the thing it should be, you project this kind of, it's trying to be bigger, but it isn't. It's a kind of a nice sort of, it's a consolation prize.
Maybe.
Like a miniature croissant.
Yeah.
Very cute.
You just think, I could just nibble that, No, I think it's like you incuten something because you're saying, it's not necessarily a negative patronising kind of thing, but there's nothing wrong with a small crab. It's a perfectly serviceable crab.
Well, because you couldn't eat it much.
No, but you because but you imagine seagull, a bigger crab.
You could lick it.
You
could give a jack.
To link that tenuously back to poems, we were talking about how the sort of form and format and the ways in which we write can dictate the sort of poems we write, whether they're long, short. Joe Dunthorne brought in this really handsome 80s electric typewriter and was saying that he would get panicked when he got to the end of the page because he could see the page running out of space. Mm. And it was interesting to think about how maybe that would have had an impact on his work.
Mm.
And you're both writers... I would say you write quite long poems, you work in sequence, especially in these newer books that you both have out. And I wonder if there's a kind of narrative urge or a sort of urge to work sequentially while also sort of remaining within the miniature that poetry lends itself to. Obviously, both sort of ways of working. There's almost like a filmic quality, I think, in both of your poems, a sort of a spanning eye that can leap across poems, but offers a spine that connects a number of different works.
Do you want to answer that?
I was thinking about that when you were talking about poets attracted to small and perfect things, because there's been this emphasis for a long time, hasn't there, on the kind of perfectly well-made poem. And that, for me, I learnt so much from that kind of school. But in the end, I kind of got impatient with it because you become so perfectionist and kind of just whittle it down to tiny bones. And I think the natural reaction to that really is then to go the other way. I think these things come and go and that will soon go back to being
minimalist again, but I certainly, for myself, I think I got frustrated and just wanted to explode that and be messier and more expansive and rougher around the edges, I think.
And I think almost working in sequence actually can lend itself quite well to, you know, practicing what you may have learned with constraint and confining right. yourself to a smaller poem, but also not having to let go of certain ideas if yeah. you need to think through things yeah. on a larger basis.
Yes, there are poems where you want to include something, but you know it doesn't serve that particular poem. If you're writing a sequence, it can perhaps reoccur later on in the sequence. But I like Fee, I think my poems have got longer over the years. And I think I'm quite interested in persona and character and the way that... but I think all the characters that I use, the personas, different personas that I use in the poems, are all either aspects of me or of people, you know, figures that I want to write about, that it would be too painful to write about if they weren't wearing this sort of mask. I mean, I suppose persona means mask, doesn't it, in Latin. The thing I like about that feeling of the mask, I'm thinking of those very ancient, you know, the Greek masks that you put on, and it's such an obvious artifice. You can see the actor behind, you can see the flesh peeping through. So you're not pretending that you're not making something up. And there are some subjects that I would just find it too painful or too difficult, too traumatic to write about without doing that. And I'm thinking actually of Fee's figure of Zeus. I have a figure that's sort of similar to that in my...
Your gaffer.
My gaffer in my book, yeah. And I think writing about, because it's from, stems from autobiography, would be too painful to do directly. And also I quite like peeping out through the eyes of a mask and inhabiting a different persona.
Yeah, we were also talking earlier about sort of the performance of poetry and how you sort of arrive in a poem and how you present whatever speaking voice you present with. And I think that sort of feeds in here as well. Like, you can sometimes find a bridge to something that you want to talk about. You know, that bridge could be like a character, an alter ego.
Anything that enables you. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's even a form. It provides that sort of distance. Mm. If you have a really difficult form to write in, it's much easier to write about traumatic subjects, I think.
I mean, the Zeus figure is completely unforgettable in your poems, Fee. And that doesn't necessarily even just come from the character. It's the frenetic energy of those poems. They're fragmentary and violent and strange and scattered but controlled. And there's something about that whole sequence that just feels you can't get it out of your head when you've read it. It's so powerful. That figure of Zeus must have been a hard one to sort of flesh out. And to think about, like, it's interesting you're saying your connection to the ephemeral, because so many of your poems have this somatic bent. They're very of the body, I think, but it's a kind of abstracted body, almost. It's a body that's sort of like lifted slightly off of the surface of the earth. I don't know if you would want to talk about how you came to that Zeus figure and how you constructed your book.
Well, let's see. So, well, because when we were talking about masks, I was thinking about, I have actually done some mask work, but a long time ago, but it's really weird. Like, masks are weird, and there's a strange, you know, there's a lot of lore, theatre lore connected with them. Like, you shouldn't ever hold them with the kind of cupped side, the bit that you put your face into. You don't hold that open because it lets out the spirit of the mask, and you don't let anybody see you put it on, and you don't touch the mask when it's on your face. But they're weird because they do kind of channel things in a strange way, and you are not yourself when you put on a mask. But then the Zeus poems, so they were about something that happened a long time ago that I wasn't, you know, I tried very hard to write about, and then it was just a disaster, so I just pushed it under the carpet, as you do with trauma. in a healthy way. Yeah, so the Zeus poems just came. I was at my parents' house looking after the girls on my own. And I had to be up in my room for some reason because my parents were doing something downstairs, I don't know, like Bible club or something, that I wasn't allowed to be downstairs, but they had provided me with cake. And these poems, the first few just came, and they came, and I put them in my note, you know, I just wrote them down, and then I didn't really think much about it. And then I went back to them and started working on them, and then they just wouldn't stop coming, really. And the Zeus ones, I wasn't seeking to flesh out anything. It really, a lot of them just did feel as if they were delivered straight into my ear. They're the most unedited work I've ever done. The ones I did have to work on more were things like the transformations. Yeah, but so some of it is mediated and some of it is not. Some of it, you know, the personal accounts are not told through a mask.
With the construction of your book then, or you're putting a book together, was it difficult to sort of align those unedited sort of given poems? We've talked about this before, the sort of difference between a poem that feels like, you know, to try and not be mystical about it, can drop into your head, or a sort of way of writing about a poem or writing a poem can just arrive to you, and maybe poems that have been worked on and sort of, you know, laboured over a couple of years. Did you find it hard to sort of smush them together?
Well, I think that's why the book's in two halves in a way, because one of them was just such a kind of furious delivery and the others came more incidentally. But I don't think they're any less for that.
No,
actually.
There are so many ways to have a poem and write a poem.
I went to hear Richard Scott singing on Saturday morning.
Oh, yeah.
And they did Wandering Angus, and Matthew told this story, and it was really sweet. He said that Robert Frost had gone to one of Yeats's soirees in the city, and he'd gone up to Yeats and congratulated him on Wandering Angus and how it was this amazing kind of free-flow poem that had obviously come to him in a sweep of inspiration. And then Yeats was really annoyed because it had taken him years and years of rigorous editing and sweat and tears. But, I mean, that's what you want, isn't it? You don't want the...
To show, you don't want to show the work.
No.
That's interesting, though. I wonder if we had these poems sort of lined up in front of us, like various poems, we'd be able to say, oh, that one took 5 minutes, that one took a year.
What, of other people's, you need to guess?
Yeah. I know that, one of my favourite facts about Elizabeth Bishop is that The Moose, in its various drafts, took 21 years.
It takes nearly 21 years for The Moose to turn up in that poem.
Yes. Oh, it's so beautiful.
Oh, I love
you wouldn't
it,
have
yes.
it any other way.
No, it's like a
the
Russian novel.
Divagations and...
all the different...
You and your Twitter generation, you just want it now,
don't
you?
Yeah, you want it in a second.
That's the whole point. We're waiting for The Moose.
I know. I've waited for enough country buses in my lifetime as well. So, you know, Moose would have been very welcome halfway between, I don't know, Heatherset and Norwich.
Would you lick it?
I'd definitely lick a moose if I could.
I would not lick a moose, but I'm vegan, so...
I'm not sure the moose would let you lick it.
You would get gnawed. What does a moose do?
It doesn't gore you.
Gore you.
To know, I think. I think
it might toss you.
Yeah.
I think we're getting off the point.
You'd die.
You can definitely. A bit felty.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, I think they'd be quite soft. But they have. They get drunk, don't they, moose? They eat the fruit that rots in the trees.
I thought that was elephants. Like, there are alcoholic elephants, aren't there?
Oh, really?
They used to go on the rampage for stills.
It's probably all animals, isn't it?
Yeah.
They've got their favourite tipple.
Yeah, probably a different fruit.
But moose, what do they like? Apples?
Yeah, apples and stuff. They'll eat them off the tree, and then they'll just be staggering around drunk in people's gardens. This is true. I have this from... This is anecdotal.
Moonshining moose.
Yeah, exactly. That sounds like a craft beer, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Moonshining, yeah. Shall we suggest it?
We should. We'll get on to...
We'll charge you for advertising.
Some of us
need work.
Moonshine moose.
Their favourite poetry.
You were going to say something about poetry, then.
I was going to say something more on track, which was, I guess, about masks. And I think maybe the thing with masks in poems or personae is not so much that they're kind of less honest, but it's just maybe they give us a permission. And actually what we realise in writing with a persona or a mask on is that we are that if we were to try and write ourselves accurately anyway, it would still be
a mask.
It would be a kind of horrible guy. You know, like it would be a weird mannequin version of ourselves. So
it would already be a persona.
Yeah, and that maybe that. So what when we write for something deliberately with a mask in mind, actually what we're saying is I need to somehow give myself permission to address that self which I already recognise as destabilised. Particularly if that destabilisation has happened as a result of trauma, that suddenly it's about accessing that trauma through something.
I mean, in that sense, it's almost more honest to write through a persona. But I do think also that we have, I mean, our identity isn't fixed. Mm. Or my identity isn't fixed.
No.
It's shifting and there are lots of different versions of me, if you like, of us all. So what do you call, you know, where is the real me within
It's time for Marguerite, doesn't it?
Do you want to read another poem each?
I'm going to read it in quite a strange way because this is a point in the sequence, if you call it a sequence, where she's gone slightly off her rocker under the pressure of Lacan. Benediction, and it's Marguerite speaking. Where am I now? Out here am I, out and rocking in my perfectly, yes I am, calm. You are now, calm you, Marguerite, and things are, all of them, very far off. My boy even, Didier, his name like a song, song I sing, dee diddy dee, for whom all this, and my girl too, who never, darling girl, she who turned up already, ah no, so, so, so already gone, long gone dead, I spilled, I said, I, oh Jesus God, but I was quiet keeping, sweetheart, unto myself, entirely unto you, my daughter, while I could, I was, inviolable. Tell me, say, the good doctor commanded, all you know. And no, I won't, you can't, is what I said for the longest time, and no one here denies it. I meant to see my one and live boy safe, that was all. I told the doctor so, exactly. Show me a mother, all that, blah, blah. And who wouldn't kill for their child? So well then, well, these things I told, enough of it. But he, so needly, on and on, his brimful voice, his sly and careful ways, and the brawn of his brown arms, that indeed was the undoing, then was the wretch of me, wretch that I am. It is he that thinks it, he, doctor, his shiny shoed going, tap, tap, feet beginning always to go, even as the nurses lead me back away. Say, le, what is it now? Say, le, how does it? Le ou les douleurs? But deaf his ears, deaf and always so, who is set to thinking he has solved the puzzle of me, good, and let him. What there is of me, what left, he took and takes, but goes too with it. Off now, off away. And for the calm that is here, and for the elsewhere of it, ever on me now, the sure release I must and do, most justly thank him, Lord. Amen, amen.
Can I ask, Julia, so you've got Celleur, is that Mallarmé again?
Is it? That's Baudelaire.
Baudelaire. And so she's kind of using Baudelaire, because he interprets that as her being pretentious, doesn't he? But in a way, she's using
it to... over-sexualised.
Right. But in a way, she's using that as a kind of mask almost, isn't she? Like, to express herself a little bit as well, is she?
Yes. Could you contextualise that poem a little bit, just for the readers as well, and within the rest of the poems, maybe?
So, the whole sequence takes place over the course of a year, and it's set in 1931 Paris. So the whole year of 1931 going into 1932, and it's from the time when Lacan was a trainee psychoanalyst, and so he examines this woman, Marguerite Pontin, who was a postal worker, and she'd been admitted to this psychiatric hospital on the outskirts of Paris after attempting to murder an actress called Huguette Duflot. So Lacan met with her over the course of this year, and he used the case to make him famous, basically. He wrote it up in his dissertation, and in fact, that was what propelled him and established his reputation. So, but all the way through the sequence, he thinks that he can work out what's wrong with her and what caused her to commit the murder. And it's all very, very simplistic. And he bullies her into eventually. At first, she won't speak at all, and then eventually she starts saying, "Yes, all right, that's how it happened, and that's why I did it." And by the end, she's destabilized at the point where that poem comes in. It's right at the end. But she hasn't given up all her secrets. There's lots that she's kept back for herself. So she's sort of pretending. So she is wearing a mask, most definitely.
It's interesting that psychoanalysis, which is such a sort of prominent, well, perhaps even like the, maybe not the beginnings, it'd be hard to say, but this idea of like the ununified subject, or, you know, getting rid of the myth of the unified subject, and that has really become such an interesting area for poets to explore. It seems like, thinking of like Nuha al-Sadir, there's been lots of projects also, you know, with the
Freud Museum.
Yeah, and it just seems like, well, that seems like a very natural kind of area, partly because, you know, with Lacan, it's obviously with language as well being central to his psycho, you know, and the development of language.
There's a Maymay Bersenbrugger, I'm not sure if you've read her, an American poet, American Chinese poet. She's really interested in Lacan as well. I think you'd like her poems.
Oh, I must look her up. Yeah. Definitely.
So it is, I think it's quite a rich area.
See, I never knew what, this is terrible, but I never pick up movements and stuff. I never feel part of anything, but that's really interesting.
I think so. With the Freud Museum, I definitely noticed they've been there's always events that involve poetry.
I think Emily Berry read some poems, didn't you, at the Freud Museum?
Well, in Stranger Baby, obviously there's a whole section in that that's sort of in conversation with Freud.
Yeah, and there's the Eleanor Marx book, which by Tara Bergen, which is sort of like...
And Noir Al-Zadir, fourth person singular. She is a psychoanalyst. So there's this really amazing... And I don't think these poets actually know each other.
Too, yeah.
They're just working from the same board.
Yeah.
Fee, would you like to read another poem for us?
Transformation, Daphne. Who roots, flares into leaf, becomes tree. But in the change before the change, Zeus's son courses her like a hound, and Daphne is a hare trying to leap free. That day at the races, a whippet lost its head in the hold, its cries leaking out of the dark trap like poisoned milk. Then clank, and all the gates lifted, and the dogs streaked out, hurtling after a dummy on casters which rattled over the sleepers of a long greased rail. The pack was an unreadable blur. Once it was over, handlers hooked their legs over the barrier and came for their dogs, clipping on each leash. Zeus behind the scenes, his electric shock collar, his snippets of meat. Out beyond the pale, there's no straight course, just waterlogged fields and Daphne's hectic blurts of speed. She's at the edge of her wits, retching with fear, and he is everywhere, stumbling her up, ahead of her, above his stink, his spit. He hollers and barks in the rough of his throat, cuffs out her legs from under her, tears at her flanks with his teeth, but still delays, and still she doubles back and jinks and faints and flees. By nightfall, she is ragged in her hind end, blood ebbed and frayed and wanting to be gone into the gentleness. Though there's this bright light, this dazzle in her eyes that won't let her sleep. She cries for her daddy like any other girl who's run beyond her strength, whose heart has failed. When a hare dies, it screams like a mortal child. Disconcerted, Apollo looks up from the field. There's Zeus in the dark, holding the lamp, keeping it steady for the rape and the kill.
Wow. Thank you. The way you retell myth is so extraordinary to me. You seem to sort of blend this historical, ancient, allegorical, fabulous way of speaking about things with almost a very grounded, earthy, ecological viewpoint. There are always sort of so many animals running through your poems alongside these retellings, these mythological retellings, and it feels... the way that you talk about landscape and the way that you talk about myth just feels incredibly new, the way you merge them. I wondered if you'd want to talk about how you access myth in this way and what sort of draws you to the retelling of myth and using it in the way that you do within your books.
I'm not so sure that it's so different from using a mask, actually. I think it's just a kind of way of telling a story. So, you know, anything like this, like a song or a painting or, you know, anything that kind of channels something you need to say is useful, I think. And I think, you know, classical myth kind of gets put on a bit of a pedestal, but it's no different to using fairy tales.
Completely.
And I think the more disrespectful of your source you can be, in a way, the more true you are to it, because a lot of them started off as oral tales anyway, so they're not enshrined in any way.
When I think about your poems, I can almost see a sort of heaven space, an earth space, and a hellscape.
Oh, really?
And I feel like you do transcend these areas. One of my favourite of your poems, actually, in your pamphlet, which I can't remember the title of now, but you're describing a person called James, and you're saying he's being bared down to the devil, I think.
Oh, no, it's the eye in the poem that's being bared down to the devil. It's poem for James.
Yeah.
Person called James, my husband.
Yeah. One of my favourite poems.
I didn't want to...
I think that's in Bright Travellers.
Yes. Yeah. And you talk about the hairs on his arms.
Yeah, and he's kind of this fierce angel. Yeah.
And there's something about, in that one poem, you've got the sort of heavens, the material body and the materiality of the landscape, and then you've got this sort of
hell.
Devil and hell, and it's complete within this poem. And I remember when I first read it, it's because I first read it in the pamphlet, that's why I'm thinking of it there.
Yeah. It is there.
I just remember thinking how you had this grasp of like almost morality, you know, in that poem space.
I've just put that poem in my anthology.
I don't think I mean to, but I used to have really bad dreams about being dragged down into hell spaces. And I think I was brought up in the church, so a lot of that is kind of in my head. And I'm not sure there's much more to say.
Are you still religious? Does that, obviously it does inform your work to some.
I don't know what I am. I practice, so I go to church, but I'm probably somewhere between agnostic and of faith. But I do think it doesn't matter what faith. I hate the idea that there's one true faith. I absolutely loathe that.
It's so interesting because my dad's a vicar, but I think I'm an atheist. I can't say that.
So I'm not going as far as atheism because I think I feel that there is something.
There's a nice word, a nice strong agnosticism or agnosticism, which is where you basically don't believe that it's possible to know either way.
That's kind of how I feel.
I think there might be something, but to gesture to it with our sort of puny
with our intellect
and brains, which are highly evolved to like moving rocks around a cave,
beyond that,
it's not something
to know.
You can apply logic to anyway.
And that seems like a pretty good... We've solved it. Okay, that's where we are.
Religion done.
That's a good place to end our podcast for today. So thank you so much, Julia and Fiona,
for coming in today and
sharing your wonderful poems. And buy their books, Girlhood from Julia and Vertigo and Ghost from Fiona, which they've been reading from today. Wonderful stuff. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack and Rachel.
And the second audio postcard for today is from Bobby Parker. And I should warn listeners that this audio postcard contains information about sexual assault and violence, which may be triggering to survivors.
Hi, this is Bobby Parker, and I would like to read to you from my recent poetry collection, Working Class Voodoo, from Offord Road Books. This poem is called Rocket and comes with a trigger warning. Rocket. I stand with a soft, stunned and penniless parents in the park, staring at our phones, over-medicated, with painful lungs and traumatic childhoods, wondering what the hell happened, drafting messages explaining everything to no one in particular. I pull a face when you call me beautiful, feeling sorry for you, believing such a thing. It never occurred to me that I might be beautiful, that anything I did could ever be described as beautiful. The dirty boys made sure of that. It was my fault, the things they did to me. I believed this for such a long time, didn't tell anyone. Lads never do. Then I went a bit cuckoo. Girls laughed and there were clouds full of small-town rain that smelled like sweaty boys. So I made friends with blood. I painted my body with brilliant blood and begged them all for love. But boys don't want love. They worshipped my long hair, quick to tears, cum face shivers through derelict buildings. When they held me down, I would shriek so loud, hysterical with fear, terrified this meant I enjoyed it, giggling, weak in the dirt. When you tell me I'm beautiful, I promise to try to believe you. They took so much from me that intimacy often feels as if it belongs to them and we can only borrow it when we're drunk out of our minds. On worse days, I imagine cutting my dick off and tossing it like a bargain basement rocket flashing pink stars above the factories. Until I became a man, I thought I must be a girl. Now I'm supposed to be a man, I often forget I'm anything at all. It's easy to forget there is such a thing as beautiful. When we're shivering in the park, worried about our children losing what we lost. Sunset in pieces all around us, like chopped up lifeboats. I hold my breath as my daughter disappears into the silver tunnel of the big slide, using my sleeve to wipe away the mud and rain before she comes out the other side.
This is probably the most challenging poem I think we've had to talk about on the show, not just because of its content, I think, but because of the sort of rawness of the lyric, actually. It feels like access to a life where that access is there's something at stake that's very clear and very real.
And as much as the content, I think one of the things that makes this poem so immensely powerful is it bridges times and it seems to bridge place, and there's such a massive spectrum between tenderness and gentleness and violence that seems to be contained all in one poem. There seems to be a real understanding of the necessity of tenderness and gentleness alongside violence that I find really extraordinary and almost quite forgiving in the space of this poem. And there's so many different spaces that are sort of cast really memorably, like the derelict buildings. And I think
that's sort of like the really like cinematic and sudden image of like the cum faces in derelict buildings. It's
and that so close to the sort of gentleness of somebody wiping away the dirt on the silver big slide in the playground. Yeah. All these things are immediately recognisable and so close to us, and they are just imbued with these massive connotations that are so carefully held within the poem.
There's these sort of things are being plattered, aren't they? There's the sort of the question of how somebody who's had this done to them can be beautiful, or like the inadequacy of that term, really, to sort of refer stably to the variety of experiences that they're having as like a parent, as a survivor, as somebody clearly in a relationship where somebody is calling them beautiful and loves them. That these kind of the way these things are managed, like the terms feel bad, they feel wrong, like. Now I'm a man, you know, and not knowing even what that thing is as a result of that kind of...
And I think about this poem and also Bobby Parker's poems, perhaps in general, as sort of in this new kind of wave of poets, male poets approaching a kind of idea of masculinity or performed masculinity, like Wayne Holloway Smith and Anthony Anaxagoru. And I feel it sometimes in Luke Kennard's poems, actually, as well. There's kind of a reappraisal or a reapproach of what it means to be a man and to perform that sort of role, and I find it really disconcerting and moving and vulnerable.
Well, I think that there's also this the fact that this is a sort of a working class lyric poet. Poetry can be so bourgeois, and its sort of performance of kind of life and I suppose like there's the cliche of sort of poetic suffering, that this sort of really cuts through it. And I think it's sort of Bobby's work is so necessary in a landscape which has a kind of an idea of radicalism being very anti-lyric or
just formal, perhaps.
Or this sort of more mainstream kind of very like highly mannered discussion of trauma and class. I mean, it begins with these soft, stunned and penniless parents. Like, I think it's sort of like, how often do you have a poem that begins with somebody saying, I'm penniless, essentially, you know? Like that intervention is so important, because I think poetry is still too middle class.
It amazes me how he manages to contain, actually, the sort of the massiveness of human experience, and also particularly working class experience, within characters and within poems, and how he's able to. It's not a trope at all. It's a completely tested sort of lyric experiment, I feel like, in his poetry. Like, he tests the boundaries of what he can talk about, and what his characters can talk about, and how they present themselves. And that's why, when I read his poems and when I heard this poem, I feel this really visceral response inside myself, because I can feel those, you know, regular boundaries and regular borders being completely tested.
Well, and we're used to talking about sort of radical embodiment, or this new radical embodiment in poetics, and this sort of neo-lyric, we're in a big renaissance of new lyrics, and it's not like white middle-class heterosexual men having their universal experiences. These new lyrics are coming from necessarily different perspectives, and that embodiment for a black body, for a disabled body, for a woman's body, or an LGBT body. Those are new perspectives, and they're kind of like reimagining this lyric. But I think the working class body here, that's also like a body that's been subjected to violence,
and to admit to that violence as well, as a sort of, to be a male working class writer and to admit to that violence and to admit how it's made you vulnerable, that's radical. That's a radical action.
I think it's kind of, It calls bullshit, actually, on other so-called radical poetics, which do nothing but sort of enshrine the cerebral niceties of language games and text and theory. You know, this is that we have to have all of them, and they are all radical. But I think
I'm very glad for this kind of radicalism.
Yeah, I think it's so vital. And, you know, I just think that Bobby Parker is an amazing poet, and you know, it's to have a poem like this on the podcast is a, you know, an honour, isn't it?
It's an honour. And our final audio postcard is from Wendy Cope, and it's taken from her new collection, Anecdotal Evidence, published by Faber & Faber.
To my husband. If we were never going to die, I might not hug you quite as often or as tight, or say goodbye to you as carefully if I was certain you'd come back to me. Perhaps I wouldn't value every day, every act of kindness, every laugh as much if I knew you and I could stay forever as each other's other half. We may not have too many years before one disappears to the eternal yonder and I can't hug or touch you any more. Yes, of course that knowledge makes us fonder. Would I want to change things if I could and make us both immortal? Love, I would.
You've been listening to the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Jack Underwood and Rachel Allen, produced by Jack Underwood, Rachel Allen, and Hannah Marshall for Faber and Faber. You can listen to us on all your favourite podcast platforms, and don't forget to tell your friends and subscribe.